I call this meeting of the House Finance and Policy Committee to order. It's Wednesday, March 18th, and we have a quorum present. First, a reminder about our committee rules. Signs are not permitted in the committee room. Verbal outbursts, shouting, applause, and other disruptions are not allowed. Sitting or standing in the aisles is not permitted, and the State Patrol and House Security staff are present to ensure everyone's safety. If you leave the committee room, please hang on to your tickets to re-enter the room. So we're going to start today with House File 3939 from Chair Bierman. Chair Bierman, would you like to move your bill before the committee?
Yes, please, Madam Chair.
Chair Bierman moves that House File 3939 before the committee be laid over for possible inclusion. Chair Bierman, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members. Members, this bill honors the service of the Hartman family while continuing their commitment to putting more good into the world and improving the lives of others. I'm going to let Ms. Elisa Golub, who's the Executive Director of Helping Paws, begin, and then we will also hear from Angie Foley. And I don't know that we'll hear from Orla. She's been pretty quiet so far. But if you want to just proceed and talk about your company and
the work. Ms. Golub, please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Chair Backer, and Chair Bierman, and the members of the committee. My name is Elisa Golub. I'm the Executive Director of Helping Paws, and thank you for the opportunity to be here tonight. And sitting next to me is Angie Foley and Orla. Angie and Orla are a graduate team from Helping Paws. 9 months ago, almost to the day, Minnesota changed. I woke up on June 14th to my phone ringing off the hook, just as I imagine many of you did. It didn't make sense then, and it doesn't make sense now. In the days that followed the tragic news of Gilbert being shot alongside Melissa and Mark, Helping Paws became, as one person said, a place to put my grief. We took this responsibility seriously. We allowed people to share their feelings, call, send cards, make donations. We gave interviews and tours. One of those calls and visits came from Chair Bierman. He asked what he and the caucus could do to create a lasting legacy for Gilbert. After a brief discussion, an idea struck me. We were approaching the breeding of the G litter. What if you sponsor a puppy from the upcoming G litter? We name our litters in alphabetical order to keep track. I decided then that we would name this particular litter after Gilbert in that moment. Chair Bierman said, how about we sponsor the whole litter? Let's ensure that anyone who wants a service dog from Helping Paws can get one. I was stunned. Still stunned a week later when he came for a visit. I hold a tremendous amount of gratitude in my heart for his belief in the mission that Melissa and Mark championed when they trained Minnie and Gilbert. What makes this even more remarkable is the host home of the mother dog, Petra, was Melissa's neighbor, and they trained dogs together. In fact, Jordy, dog sat for Gilbert. Petra was initially supposed to have the F litter, but she wasn't ready. And now she's going to have the Guided by Gilbert litter. In another remarkable twist of fate, I realized as we were getting ready for this litter to come that the timing for this litter to start training will coincide with the anniversary of the shootings. Mr. Chair Backer and Bierman and committee members, your investment in supporting this litter is incredibly important to our staff and the Hartman family. The state's financial support will ensure a lasting legacy and a ripple effect touching many lives throughout the coming years. I have said to my staff and community that we will say Melissa, Mark, and Gilbert's name every day at Helping Paws. We will honor them by bringing light into the darkness, and this litter that this bill will support will carry their spirit and change lives just as Melissa, Mark, and Gilbert have changed all of ours. Thank you, Chairman Backer and Bierman and committee members, for all you do. Together, we can change so many lives through the use of a service dog. I'm happy to answer any questions later on, but I'd like for you now to hear from Angie and Orla.
Thank you so much for your testimony, Ms. Golub. And next, Ms. Foley, if you would identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Yeah, can you, everyone hear me okay?
Mm-hmm.
All right, my name is Angie Foley, and I'm with my service dog, Orla, and I am a graduate of Helping Paws. And thank you, Elisa. Thank you to Mr. Chair Backer and Bierman and members of the committee for the honor of being able to speak before you as someone who has been involved with Helping Paws for over 20 years and have received the gift of independence four times through the partnerships with my service dogs, Milo, Baylor, Pepper, and now Orla. In June, Pepper and I had the privilege of being part of the Helping Paws Honor Guard during Melissa, Mark, and Gilbert's line in state at the Capitol Rotunda. It was especially meaningful because Gilbert was actually Pepper's nephew. And I believe Orla was there too with her volunteer foster home trainer at the time. In addition to receiving service dogs through Helping Paws, I have been very involved in the organization through attending their events, volunteering with the organization, serving on the board of directors for 9 years, and serving as 2 years as the board president, speaking on graduate panels to foster home trainers about my experience having a service dog, and playing a role through my background as a clinical psychologist to help develop and implement our program with veterans and first responders with PTSD. I do not do this out of obligation to an organization that has literally changed my life for the better. I do all this because it is a way that I can give back to Helping Paws and show how grateful I am for everything they do for myself and other people with disabilities. When people think of Helping Paws, they likely think of puppies, Goldens, and Labradors. But when I think of Helping Paws, I think about the people, from the dedicated staff to the caretaker homes that provide the foundation for our breeding program, to the graduates, but mostly to the volunteer foster home trainers like Mark, Sophie, and Melissa Hortman that dedicate so much of their time and energy to only selflessly hand over these gifts of independence to someone who needs them more than they do. I knew the Hortmans and interacted with them at various Helping Paws events over the years. I do not have to tell you how wonderful they are, and I am not going to use the past tense because I am a strong believer that they never really leave us because their legacy remains. Most of the recipients of service dogs are on fixed and limited incomes. If they had to pay for the cost of all the expenses that go into training, caring for these dogs for their 2.5 years, it would be out of reach for mostly everyone. We really depend on donations, sponsorships, fundraising, and other avenues to carry out our mission. Graduates only pay application fee and then a nominal equipment fee when they receive their service dogs. I can think of no better way to honor the Hortmans and Gilbert's legacy than to sponsor the Guided by Gilbert litter. On behalf of a very grateful service dog team, I want to thank you, Mr. Chair Backer and Bierman, and the committee members for the hard work that you do on behalf of all of Minnesota. At first, I thought we were going to be going last, so I had said that since this is a very special meeting, the rules of not petting a working dog were going to be waived this evening. So,
Still
they are.
Come here, Orla.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony, and thanks to both you and Orla for being here. Is there Is there anyone in the public who wishes to testify? Not seeing any. Any discussion to the bill? Representative Keeler.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Chair Bierman. Well, I really love this bill, I think for obvious reasons, right? We were actually just talking about, because it is kind of fun to talk about Gilbert. And those of us who were here in 2020 in the middle of a pandemic, probably don't want to hear this, but how excited Melissa was that Gilbert failed.
Yeah.
you know, and it was like this realization that, you know, our dogs are really such a big part of our family. And I just love that we're doing this. But more than that, one thing I want to highlight is, you know, Melissa had a big fondness for our firefighters and the work that they do in our community. And the overlap here is just so beautiful. I remember when I came in and we had this really cool conversation over tea about Gilbert and like, why? Why did, you know, she's so busy, you know, and you're like the speaker and like, why would you take this on? And she really just highlighted, and I think it's important to share like the love that Melissa really had for service and for other people and for taking this on. And she really talked about that this is like saving people's lives. And through the tragedy, we've really learned a lot about what that means and what these partnerships and genuinely family members can provide for us. And so thank you for the work that we do. Thank you for bringing this. Thank you for sharing the work that you do, but also thank you for giving us a moment to just reflect on our friend and the work that the service outside of these walls that she did as an action with being a home for Gilbert and others. Thank you.
Representative Mahmoud.
I just want to say this is such a beautiful way to carry on Speaker Hortman's legacy and to remember her and to honor her. And I just thank you so much for the training that you're doing and the work that you're doing. It's just so beautiful. So thanks.
Representative Carroll.
Thank you. This might get a little bit repetitive, but thank you so much for bringing both of you for coming and bringing Orla. I first met you. You're the executive director at Melissa's Lion and State, and you had the dogs there. And my first instinct was to reach out and pet them, but then I realized that I shouldn't do that, and I think you gently said, "Don't you dare." No, I'm exaggerating. But what I've learned, because I grew up with Goldens, and I thought, and I have three daughters, I thought it was a God-given right to have Goldens growing up. We all wanted one except for one person. Would somebody please talk to my wife?
No.
So, anyway, my sister got a Golden, and so she would. My wife would say, "Well, go over and you can see Lily over there." So, but anyway, Goldens are very special. Other breeds are too, but I'm extremely partial to Goldens. When I see Orla, it just brings back a lot of memories, a lot of smiles. And thank you for your service. Thank you for what you're doing.
Thank you.
Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Representative Bierman. And thank you for this incredible way to honor the people that serve all of us. I think these dogs really are a lifeline for folks. Our veterans, our responders, so folks suffering from PTSD, and whether Gilbert knew it or not, he was doing an incredible service for Melissa. She was worried and afraid, but in training Gilbert, she also had the opportunity to train a dog for someone else that she knew really needed it. But I used to sit next to her in the caucus room all the time. And she talked many times about what she was going to do when it was time for Gilbert to be done and to move to his new home. She referred to him as her shadow. and said, I don't know what I'm going to do. But she came in one day, and I remember she sat down, and I told everybody she looked like the cat who swallowed the canary. And she said, Gilbert failed his test. Oh, darn, I'm just going to have to keep him. And just the look of, she felt terrible, of course, because she was really training him for someone else. But at the same time, he brought her so much comfort. And I think even in the end, he did. I had a dream right during that time where I saw Melissa going up over a hill just before this happened. And she looked back at me, and I saw Gilbert trailing behind her as she went up over the hill and disappeared over the hill. I didn't understand what it meant, but shortly thereafter, I got the call that Melissa was gone. I grew up with dogs, and I can tell you the amount of comfort that they can bring. Unfortunately, I am not blessed to have one right now, but I will just tell you, I understand that comfort. I understand the comfort it brought to Melissa, and I see the way in which service dogs make a difference to their families. They make a fundamental difference. And so I just want to thank you for doing this work. I want to thank the host families for their work. It's got to be incredibly hard to give up their dogs, but knowing that they're doing this in a way that really changes people's lives, it really matters. And so I want to thank you, Representative Chair Bierman, and to all of the folks at Helping Paws, to Orla, to all of you. Just thank you. Really appreciate it.
Thank you all for the comments. Chair Bierman, any closing comments?
Thank you, members. Helping Paws has been doing this work for 38 years, and their dogs are across the state. They've been on the news. You may have seen them. When I spoke to Elisa the first time, she indicated there was a dog at the middle school near me, so I went over to see Herbie in action, and he has been a source of calm and connection for students in that middle school. And according to staff, when Herbie joined the staff, attendance went up, behavioral issues went down, and he even makes house calls when certain students are afflicted by some tragedies in their lives, and he's been helpful in getting them back to school. So just want to say, too, the funding in the bill will be used strictly for nurturing and training the therapy dogs to improve human lives in very miraculous ways. And this bill honors the legacy, but it carries it forward in a way that continues to serve others just like the Hortman family did. And this is truly something that it's for all of us to carry forward, and appreciate your support. Thank you.
Thank you. I'll close with my gratitude for sharing these experiences, giving us another chance to heal, to revisit the people we care about, and to look toward the future. I appreciate it very much. And now, Chair Bierman renews the motion that House File 3939 be laid over for possible inclusion, and the bill is laid over.
Madam Chair.
I know, next time.
All right. Next bill on the agenda today is House File 3769. Representative Curran, welcome to the committee, Representative. I'll move the House File 3769 be recommended to be placed on the General Register. Representative Curran, I understand you have an A1 technical amendment. Would you like to speak to the A1?
It's pretty simple, just inserting some clarifying language that someone has to have a testing upon intake or annually, not just annually.
Thank you, Representative Curran. I'll move the A1 amendment. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. All right, let's give you opening remarks, Representative Curran. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Chair and committee members. The bill before you today comes from the Department of Corrections with some, as we typically have, some technical updates from the agency. I'll spare you my commentary and kick it over to the experts.
Very good. Okay, testifiers on the docket here. Kelly Half, if you would please introduce yourself into the microphone and proceed with your testimony.
Perfect. Thank you, Chair and members of committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Kelly Half. I serve as Legislative Director for the Department of Corrections. House File 3769 is the DOC's technical omnibus bill, which contains provisions that update or modernize sections of statute pertaining to the work of the agency. Hard act to follow, as some members said as we came up here, but today I'm going to talk about tuberculosis, the tuberculosis sections of the statute. So sections 1 through 3. TB is a highly contagious disease that can spread quickly in congregate settings such as correctional facilities. Because of this, state law requires screening for TB. However, it's not clearly outlined the process for when an incarcerated person refuses that screening. Because of this, the bill establishes a clear legal pathway and timeline for addressing refusals, mirrored after other bloodborne pathogen testing procedures and statute. It also updates statute to reflect modern testing methods consistent with guidance from the U.S. Public Health Service and improves the timeline for screening. These updates will ensure consistent TB screening practices and support public health within correctional facilities. Thank you to Representative Curran and Chair and members. I'm happy to stand for any questions you may have.
Thank you very much, Ms. Huff. Any other members of the public wishing to testify? Seeing none, we will go to discussion to the bill. Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Curran, or your testifier, does this bring any more cost on the counties?
Ms. Half.
It shouldn't. This testing already has to occur, and it does not increase the frequency of occurring.
Representative Hewitt, follow up.
Thank you, Chair. It sounds budget neutral then.
Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't think that's true. The Manto testing test is about $10, and the QRX test is over $80. And so there is a cost, and especially to our jails now that are receiving more and more people, there's a cost to segregation. Because now you're putting something in law that allows their appeal process to take place versus where we could just, a jailer could request a commissioner to force that inmate to submit. So you've got segregation costs while that process goes along. And anytime an inmate goes in where there's, and let me back up because, our health assessment teams in jails are super effective. They're really good. They recognize those things. They go through the testing. The language at the beginning of the bill, that kind of changes with within 14 days of intake. And I don't know all jails very well. I know mine pretty well. And the average stay pre-adjudication is, 9 to 12 days. Okay, so that part of the language I don't think matters that much because we try to do health screening. Most jails try to do health screening at intake for the most part. TB testing is a little bit different, and so I think that it's important. Why don't why don't you talk about why the QRX test is necessary today, rather why it's not, why MANTO is not working as well.
Ms. Huff.
So the legislation is actually an or. So it's either MANTO testing or, and it just adds QuantiFERON Gold Plus testing as an option. So they can still use the previous methods of testing. As for the segregation costs, speeding up the timeline will hopefully decrease the costs of individuals in segregation. Right now, at least at the Department of Corrections, where this bill idea came from, it, as people sit in segregation, as they refuse testing, they have to wait for the court process, and this would speed up the court process. The Commissioner of Corrections already has the authority to order that testing, but because of the ambiguity of how that is supposed to proceed, this adds that clarification in law and will speed up that testing and decrease the amount of times folks are waiting in restrictive housing.
Representative Nadeau.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I mean, I'll just point you to language 1.19 to 1.20. I mean, that's being strict. I mean, that's about as much power as the commissioner has. I mean, he can order, I mean, current law is quite specific in that if that inmate refuses, the commissioner of corrections may order that inmate to be tested. May, if the commissioner is uncomfortable doing it, I recognize that, that's fine. But I don't think that the language in this bill is not specific. But I think when we talk about this new test, I mean, part of the reason that we're doing this, and I think it's important, I just want to point out that Representative Hewitt is right. There is a cost that counties are going to bear here. The MANTO test is less effective for European and African-born folks because of the vaccines that they receive, and the MANTO test produces false negatives. All right, so that's the problem. The QRX test does not. It's a better test. It's more effective, and it should be used. The only reason I'm saying this is that it is going to increase costs on the counties. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Seeing no other questions, Representative Hewitt.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to clarify, I asked that question very clearly because I was not seeing a cost in here, and I heard that there might have been other testimony in the other committee that said there was no cost. But I also want to say that as a medical person and putting somebody into confinement with other inmates, this is really catching things like that we don't want other inmates exposed to because it's pay me now or pay me later and a lot. And so I think these are really good things to look at before you put somebody in. And seriously, $10 is going to save us a lot of money, and I if that's the cost, well, I guess I'm willing to say that's okay because, you know, but I don't think it is. So I just wanted to clarify that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Seeing no further questions, Representative Curran, closing comments.
Thank you again, Chair and committee members. I appreciate your time. This bill really just provides the department with the clarity needed to do the processes that they're already doing. Thank you.
Thank you. I renew the motion that House File 3769, as amended, be recommended to be placed on the general register. Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
The motion prevails, and House File 3769, as amended, is recommended to be placed on the general register. Thank you, Representative Curran. Moving on, we will take up House File 3978 from Vice Chair Ryer. Vice Chair Ryer moves. Would you like to move your bill?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair.
To be placed on the general register, Vice Chair Ryer moves that House File 3978 be recommended to be referred to and placed on the general register. Vice Chair Ryer, to your bill.
Thank you, Chair Bierman, Chair Backer, and members. House File 3978 is an entirely technical bill. It cleans up legislation that passed last year that established a provider wellness program that was aimed at addressing healthcare worker burnout and increased rates of mental health concerns among our healthcare providers. It alters language about a provider wellness program established in House File 1645. It changes the eligibility from just targeting physicians to targeting all healthcare providers. The wellness program could include offerings such as peer-to-peer counseling and mental health services. And this bill extends eligibility and associated confidentiality protections for those who participate in that program to include all healthcare providers. As established last year, it includes only physicians. This initiative is led by the Minnesota Medical Association, which works collaboratively with other care providers and their organizations in the shared goal to reduce rates of provider burnout and associated implications on the healthcare workforce in the state. This is a good program targeted to the needs of our care providers. And to any members of the public who may be struggling, 988 offers 24/7 judgment-free support for mental health, substance use, and more. Text, call, or chat 988. Thank you.
Thank you, Vice Chair Iyer. We do not have any testifiers. Any members of the public wishing to testify to this bill? I'll just note that there is an issue briefing from the Minnesota Medical Association describing the rationale for allowing this program to serve all healthcare professionals, not just physicians. Members, any discussion to the bill? Representative Ndo.
Thank you, Chair Bierman and Representative Breyer. Can you tell me a little bit about, I work for a company that has insurance and there's a wellness program. So this one's in statute and it's specifically for statewide associations exempt from taxation. Is there something specific? What am I missing here? I mean, we're going to talk about MCOs in a little bit here, and there's quite a bit of money that's spent on wellness, and I don't have any problem with adding healthcare worker to the physicians. I'm just curious why we're doing it.
Vice Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Vice Chair Nadeau. To me, it's a matter of looking at workforce. We have any number of workforce programs. We do things to support workers in a number of fields and disciplines. We know that we're losing healthcare providers from the field because of the burnout, the stress, increasing mental health issues, and so providing support that the Minnesota Medical Association, in collaboration with a dozen other groups, can put together and to serve their members seems to me to be a good investment in protecting our healthcare workforce.
Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, and thank you, Representative Breyer. So this would be, these are dues, insurance, components that are paid for by these professional associations. Part of their insurance is they're aligning them. I think it's a good idea. I just still don't understand if it's redundant, if it's new, we're hitting more people.
Vice Chair Iyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Vice Chair Nadeau. I see. This is more of a communication, taking out the barriers, helping people understand what resources are available. It's not providing coverage for more mental health, and I'll let my friends correct me if I'm wrong. Oh, in fact, I can phone a friend.
Would you please introduce yourself to the committee and proceed?
Thank you, Chair. Chad Fang from the Minnesota Medical Association. As mentioned, this is separate. This has nothing to do with insurance. This is a separate program that was funded last year, separate initiative that offers things like peer-to-peer counseling and potential mental health services. Right now, it's targeted towards just physicians. This would expand, especially those confidentiality protections, to all healthcare professionals.
So, thank you. Separate.
Representative Ndo.
Thank you. Now we're getting somewhere. I appreciate it.
You bet.
Okay, so is that an ongoing funding source? Was it one-time dollars? And there's just dollars that haven't been spent so that we're increasing access to it?
Mr. Fanning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, that was one-time spending from last year.
Representative Ndo.
And so what was the appropriation?
Mr. Fanning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. $250,000 last year.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Nadeau. Representative Becker, or co-chair Becker.
Either works. Thank you, Chair. Question is, are there any triggers that would require disclosure to the license board? Or is this totally shielded if somebody comes in and they have challenges? How is that handled to the licensing board?
Mr. Fanning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know. I can get back to you, but right now I do not believe that reports to the licensing board.
Follow up?
No, I would appreciate that follow up because that's important because I know Vice Chair Ryer understand what you're trying to do. I think the easiest way, but of course there's cost, is getting more people into the workplace so we can lower the stress load and so forth. So I think that would, even though I see where you're going with this, I think that would be a better focus on getting more people in the profession so we can limit the load. I would like to see that somehow, but I would like to know the triggering. You know, does that hurt? Because obviously if we have a wellness program, people feel if they say something, it gets triggered, then we don't get our end in mind. So thank you. That's it.
That's it. All right. Representative Van Binsbergen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A quick question about funding. So just point of clarification. So we appropriated $250,000 last year, correct? Mm-hmm. And we're expanding the program to...
Mr. Fanning. Mr. Fanning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There is no new money in this bill.
I realize, but there's no new money, but we're going to add more people to the wellness program, right? So, and that can be done without any extra dollars going in.
Mr. Fanning.
I appreciate that. The intent of last year's bill was to expand this to all providers, but it was written for just physicians. So the intent of the $250,000 was for all healthcare professionals last year.
Follow up, Mr.
No,
Representative?
Thank you.
Okay, seeing no more members, let's see, closing comments, Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for the discussion, everyone. I'm eager to see this move forward. I'm pleased to see it broaden out to reach the original intent of covering all our healthcare providers who do so much for us. Thank you.
Thank you. Vice Chair Ryer renews her motion that House File 3978 be referred to the Ways and Means. Oh, so the General Register, apologies. The General Register, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
And the motion prevails and 3978 is recommended to be placed on the General Register. You want a division?
Yep.
Hands? So those in favor, please raise your hands for aye. And you got to get a count.
Really?
The ayes have it.
Ayes have it.
Do we need to do a count? I think the ayes have it. We should be good. Motion prevails and House File 3978 is recommended to be placed on the General Register as amended. Thank you, Vice Chair Ryer. Okay, moving on, we will be up to House File 3476. Chair Liebling. Representative Liebling moves her bill, House File 3476, in front of the committee to be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Representative Liebling, I understand you have the A1 amendment. Would you please explain and move your amendment?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. The Senate already heard the bill and adopted the same amendment, so I'm lining up the language, and it's really just kind of clean up, and it doesn't do anything very substantive, just kind of some clarifying language. So that is the A1.
Okay, Representative A1. Moves the adoption of the A1 amendment. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. We'll move to testifiers, unless you want to talk about your bill.
Yeah, I would like to, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Well, we won't go right to testifiers.
Yeah, no, and thanks for like having us talk about Gilbert and Melissa Hortman first. I mean, I have to say I'm kind of haven't recovered from that quite, but and I also realize that I'm sort of standing between members and dinner probably, so I apologize for that, but here we are. Members, this is about, let me just give a little background. So about 40 years ago, Minnesota decided to contract with health insurance companies to administer the Medicaid program. The system is called PMAP, Prepaid Medical Assistance Program. And any of you who have been in health for any period of time know that we do a ton of acronyms around here, and this bill is full of them, and I'm sorry about that, but it is what it is. The health insurance companies are called by various names and acronyms, HMOs, which means health maintenance organizations, MCOs is used a lot, managed care organizations, or sometimes we simply call them health plans. I don't want to use the term MCO, managed care organization, because I think that's a misnomer, because what they do is not manage care. Primarily, they manage money, and that is part of what we're going to be talking about. The reasons that Minnesota went to this plan about 40 years ago, of course, I wasn't around then. I know some of you might think I was, but I wasn't. And from what I can discern, it was thought at that time that Medicaid patients might get better access to care by accessing the same provider networks that were available to commercial customers, or that insurance companies would save, that we would save money for the state by managing care. But all these years later, this is still a demonstration project. It is actually called that. And in fact, the system has never been proven to be better than direct payment. It has never been proven. And I want to just, in the outset here, I want you to understand how much money we're talking about here that go through our public programs. I did sort of a quick review, and the nearest I can tell, we spend about $10 billion per year on our public programs, per year, and of course a lot of federal money too, so it's probably north of $20 billion per year of taxpayer money to pay for our public health care programs. That's a lot of money and a lot of responsibility for us as legislators, and the question is, are we getting what we should be getting for that money? Are we spending it the right way? Do we have proper oversight of it? And my answer to that is clearly not. So here's how the current system works. Instead of paying for doctors and providers directly, the state pays the middleman, who then pays the providers. The payment is a flat fee per patient, which is called capitation. And calculating what those capitation rates should be is a big deal, major project, which has gone different directions during my time here in the legislature. The insurer is then responsible for managing, for paying for care and quote unquote managing care for the person. But as I said, they really don't mostly manage care, they mostly manage money. The companies are supposed to be taking the risk that the costs will be within what was paid, but under rules from the federal government, CMS, the rates are supposed to be actuarially sound, quote unquote, actuarially sound, so the companies don't lose money over time. If they lose money, the state simply pays them more the next time. So also, we are adding to our system here administrative costs and bureaucratic red tape, and obviously putting a middleman in the middle, and there are several of these companies doing this, is driving up costs. We talked earlier today about complications in our healthcare and how we often don't even understand what they are and where the money is flowing. One of the things this bill does is it sunsets a program called the Integrated Health Partnership Program. I wonder how many of the legislators in this room even know that exists. Integrated Health Partnership Program is called the IHP program. So this is just an example of how out of control this whole thing has gotten. That's a program that's been running since 2013. It was actually enacted in 2010. That also pays providers for the same public health care patients, pays them a population-based payment for care, and also shares the risk with them. With more, and right now it's more than 25 healthcare providers, including, for example, Allina, Fairview, and Mayo, and many smaller ones. And these are patients who are also, many of them, are also patients of the so-called managed care companies. So you might wonder, why do we need to have both of these things? To which I say, we don't, and we should stop doing it. So the system we have does not deliver better care or better outcomes for patients. It doesn't save money. It's never been shown to save money. It has duplicative overhead, and we spend a lot of money, I assume, although it's very hard to find out exactly how much, negotiating the contracts and managing the organizations. So there's a lot of overhead. It does not encourage healthcare providers to serve public patients because there are confusing different requirements for the different companies, complicated billing, payment delays, and they're billing different entities for people who are on the very same program. And very importantly, it doesn't help catch or prevent fraud and abuse. Each of the companies has proprietary anti-fraud systems, and they don't share best practices with each other, or as near as I can tell, with the state. And even if there are fines or penalties or assessments against them, or if they lose money to fraud, it is paid for by the taxpayer, not the companies. This is often referred to as a black box, and I'm sure many of you in this room have referred to it as a black box, and that is a really big problem because all this money is flowing through it, and our constituents rightly believe that we are making the decisions about where that money goes and that we are somehow accountable for it. And the reality is that we don't have the information we would need to oversee this program, and it's so complicated it's pretty darn near impossible to oversee. But 85% of Minnesotans who are on either our medical assistance or Minnesota Care programs are in this PMAP program, prepaid medical assistance program. And I've been told that about 80% of the money flows through this program. So just so we're clear, the state also operates a small fee-for-service program, which is where people, mostly people with disabilities, are in that program. It's a different population, and those people's care is paid for directly by DHS. It is a different population. But what we have right now is so complicated that policymakers can barely understand how the system works, much less manage it. Especially at a time when we're all so concerned about fraud and abuse, we need to remove the costly layers of bureaucracy that waste money and make management so difficult. Connecticut dropped the managed care organizations from their Medicaid program back in 2012, and they got big savings from doing so. Minnesota is not the only state considering this now. Other states also have bills and are working on it, including Illinois, Wisconsin, Indiana, Maryland, New York, West Virginia, Missouri, Ohio, Hawaii, and Iowa, I understand. So this bill before you, House File 3476, would eliminate the middlemen in Medicaid and Minnesota care. It would eliminate barriers to care, which includes networks, different drug formularies, prior authorizations, and confusion. It would, for the first time, we would have real care coordination and case management for medical professionals and counties, and that would be paid for separately, and that is real managed care, not just a name. We would have more transparency and accountability with no more proprietary rates or proprietary anti-fraud systems, because that is one of the problems that the companies say, we can't tell you what we pay a dentist in Wilmer. That's proprietary. So if you want to find out, you're not going to find out. They won't tell you. We the legislature, would have better visibility into where the money's going and be able to adjust payment rates and policies to meet our goals, such as to provide better access to care in shortage areas. All of us want to be good stewards of our public money, and that is why moving to a direct payment system makes so much sense. It not only would save money by eliminating the middleman, but the reduction in complexity and bureaucracy allows us to have more focused oversight of the money. Eliminating complexity increases transparency and accountability. So that's kind of my opening, Mr. Chair, and I understand that we do have a testifier online, I hope.
Yes, we will move to the first testifier on the list is virtual, and it is Mr. Sheldon Tobman. I will just mention to members there is a letter in your packets from the Connecticut speaker who led this endeavor in Connecticut and implemented this. So take a look at that if you have a chance. And Mr. Tobman, are you on the line?
I am.
All right, if you would speak up a little bit and introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony, please.
Sure, thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Sheldon Tobman. I'm an attorney with currently with Disability Rights Connecticut, which serves people with a range of disabilities. And before that, for 30 years, and during most of the time that I'm going to talk about today, I was an attorney at New Haven Legal Assistance Association, a legal aid office. Our story started in 95. We rolled out with MCOs, and the promise was that they were going to save money and improve care. We started out with 11 entities, mostly for profit, a couple of nonprofits, and we were promised it would save money, and we were guaranteed it was going to save money because the plan was that after the first year, they'd be paid the same as the rates would be if we didn't have them, but then the second year we would drop it to 95%. So we set it up that we'd be saving 5%, which is a big deal. That never happened. And the story after that is, of course, they always demand more money and they basically got it. There were so many problems that developed pretty early on, like very early on. Network inadequacy and the comment I just heard about how the plans promised you'd have our large commercial plans as your providers, and that was not true. For those MCOs that were that also had commercial business, they were separate networks. The Medicaid network was a second class. Excessive prior authorization, burdensome prior authorization, confusing prior authorization, such that providers would give up and not even bother requesting it. Noncompliance with basic due process, meaning under Medicaid, federal law, whenever services are denied, you have to give written notice and explain why and all that, a right to a hearing, and they just weren't doing it. I mean, this is early on. And then, of course, the high costs. And high costs both in total dollars, but also in, you know, we couldn't really get it in the early years, but how much seems to be going for administrative costs here. And that's not just bureaucracy and profits, but also marketing, because there's multiple plans and they each have to market because they're in competition with each other. And then overriding all of it was a basic lack of transparency. We could not get good information. We had something called the Medicaid Managed Care Council, which theoretically provided oversight, but the reality is that we could not get information. And as we just heard, the same thing as with the dentist rates, it was proprietary how much the providers were being paid. So when advocates and others raise concerns that there's a too small a network and ask questions, well, maybe that's because they're being paid too little. How much are they being paid? Oh, sorry, that's proprietary. They always claim, the MCOs always claim that they did it better and cheaper. And they also said that only we can coordinate care. We're uniquely in a position to do that. None of that was true, but our state Medicaid agency in the early years always defended this and always said everything was great until it's a very slow breaking of the dam, but in May of 2005, so, you know, we're talking about 10 years into the system, the same Medicaid agency which defended the system issued a memo to the legislative leadership basically saying, we're going to carve out behavioral health from the MCO contracts. It's just not working. And so the commissioner at that agency wrote that we have to do this because we need to address, quote, fundamental deficiencies in the current system that limit the provision of timely, appropriate, and effective care to children with special behavioral health needs. The failings of the current system are numerous. There are extraordinarily long and unnecessary stays in inpatient psychiatric facilities and excessive reliance on emergency departments with discharge delays resulting in overnight stays for children. There are long delays in accessing outpatient services and uneven service quality and outcomes, and it goes on. That basically, we're going to fire them in terms of running the behavioral health part, but it was going to be many years before we got rid of the capitated managed care system entirely. Over the years, in the research we did and the advocacy we did, we found very low medical loss ratios, meaning a very high percentage was going to administrative costs and profits, and publicly traded companies would actually brag about having low medical loss ratios when they would talk to their investors about this. We also found there was a significant secret shopper survey that was done, well-designed study that really looked at whether providers that were listed by the MCOs really were available, and they found an abysmal 25% of the time for all the MCOs in various categories could people even get an appointment because the lists basically were largely inaccurate or just bogus. We also found fraud. There were fraudulent denials where the MCO would say something was not covered under the contract when it was. For example, prescription drugs, they would program the computers to say, sorry, the drug's not covered, when it simply required prior authorization. We did change out, at that point it was four, we changed it down to three. We got, at that point it was two commercials and one nonprofit. But the comment about actuarial soundness, right, the rates, we had an auditor come in, not we, but the comptroller's office had an auditor come in, found they were being overpaid substantially that last round of MCOs. So given all these problems, after years of fighting to get data from them, the incoming governor in 2011 took back the risk from the MCOs, contracted with ASOs, administrative service organizations, and PCMHs, patient centered medical homes, sorry about the acronyms, and we did the conversion in 11 months. We did an RFP process to bring in ASOs. We did get an ASO for behavioral health years ago when we did that first carve-out, and that ASO, though for-profit, did a great job on a non-risk basis. When it wasn't at financial risk in reviewing requests for prior authorization, it did a professional job. So we turned to managed fee-for-service, which is fee-for-service payment, not capitation, but we pay extra for primary care practices to coordinate the care, really to coordinate the care. And in addition, the ASOs do some intensive care management where they also coordinate care, particularly for high-need individuals. And since the conversion, you know, we're not perfect, but we've saved, for our little state, over $4 billion. We have very high medical loss ratios, about 97.25% of every taxpayer dollar going to the Medicaid delivery system actually goes to healthcare, not the other things. We have real coordination of care through the PCMHs and the ASOs, and we have much higher participation. When we did the conversion, there was a bit of a problem in terms of measuring because we also shortly thereafter increased primary care rates, but we did not increase specialist rates at all. And even then, there was a 19% increase in specialist participation, which is presumably because of the lack of burdens of trying to get paid and the burdens of prior authorization.
Mr. Taubman, I'll need you to finish up your testimony.
Sure. I just want to wrap this up. A question was raised by our current governor in 24 about, you know, why we're so different, right? Most states have a capitated managed care. Why are we different? And so he raised a question whether we should look into that, and the state hired a contractor consultant to look at it. We were very worried about that contractor. It was Manette Health, which represents MCOs as well as state Medicaid agencies. But amazingly, they issued a report in December of 24 that concluded that Connecticut Medicaid has 14% lower per enrollee spending than the Northeastern average. So we're cheaper, and our administrative costs are much lower, and it pointed out that Connecticut Medicaid performs above the median for greater than 70% of national adult and child quality measures. So after that, the governor agreed that we should stick with what we have, and people are happy with staying where we are, and we are unusual, but as you heard, many other states are now looking at it, and it sounds like Minnesota is as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Taubman. I hope you can stay for questions at the end. Next up, Mr. Chris Rubish, followed by Abdullah Nasser.
Thank you so much. Good evening, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Chris Rubish. I live and work in Duluth. I'm a registered nurse, and I'm proudly serving as the president of the Minnesota Nurses Association. Our union's 23,000 members represent 80% of the nurses that actively work at the bedside in Minnesota's hospitals. Our members also include healthcare workers that work in clinics, long-term care settings, veterans health, public health, our state's mental health facilities, prisons, and many other settings. MNA has a long history of supporting efforts to eliminate the most unnecessary middle agents in our healthcare system, the health insurance industry, and establishing instead a system that prioritizes patient needs before profits and red tape that health insurance companies and HMOs have become known for. Nurses have seen firsthand how hospitals deploy policies and practices seemingly tailored not to ensure that care, treatments, and medications or patient needs are front and center, but instead standardized practice that has become a series of workarounds and searches for ways to get patients what they need, despite health insurance companies denying what medical professionals say the patients primarily need. Instead of the priority being the needs of a patient, the priority has become how to appease the patient's health insurance company. And it's absolutely maddening as a nurse to see that and to have to work in that sort of system. While this bill doesn't do what MNA would love to see happen, which is eliminate the profiteers that make the health insurance industry altogether, including those who cloak themselves under the guise of being not-for-profit, but it does take a big step forward in creating the foundation for such a system and is much more effective than a pilot program. Also, it does what legislators on both sides of our political aisle should want to see happen. It saves taxpayer money. We hope that you will think of this legislation as a way to get some of the cost of health insurance administration off of the books and off of the backs of Minnesota taxpayers. This could also create opportunities for better alignment of healthcare and human services at the local level, which we know our most valuable patients often receive. Mr. Chair and committee, we hope that you will listen to nurses and healthcare workers when we say what we see every day, the way that health insurance industry is harming patients. This bill helps us take a step forward on behalf of patients. Please support House File 3476.
Thank you, Mr. Rubish. Next up, Abdullah Nasser. And please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony, please.
Good evening, Mr. Chair. My name is Abdullah Nasser. I'm a second-year medical student at the University of Minnesota. I was born and raised in Minnesota. I live in Columbia Heights right now. I'm here in support of this bill, House File 3476. I'm also here to voice the support of 80 other of my fellow peers, medical students, and faculty at the University of Minnesota Medical School who have signed a petition endorsing this specific bill. The following, I just wanted to share a few words reflecting on my own perspective as someone who was born and raised up in Minnesota here, and really that hopes to one day practice medicine in this great state as well. I'm on my second ever week right now of clinical rotations, and it was a very exciting time in my life, a transition. I'm at Hennepin County Medical Center. I really wanted to be here. I applied to be here, and I got here. I've spent some time in this hospital in my undergrad as well. And I came in with this optimism and hope of, you know, being able to serve those the most vulnerable in our community. And as you know, Hennepin County is very dependent on Medicaid to cater to its patients, majority of whom are underinsured or publicly insured. I came with this optimism and hope. And my first 2 weeks, it's been very disappointing to see, day two of my rotations, a patient who's terminally ill is asking, how long am I going to have with my doctor? Am I going to, even be able to see him continuously until I need to? We have doctors and staff who are talking about their colleagues who are let go. They're talking about departments that are being shut down. We have, faculty and staff wondering, how long am I going to get to see my patients who I've been working with for, many, many years prior. It's not quite what I expected when I started working at this hospital. These financial pressures don't exist in isolation. HCMC isn't the only one being affected by challenges to Medicaid. These past 2 weeks have raised a lot of questions for me about what exactly our health system looks like and what are we doing and what can we do to protect those who are our most vulnerable. In med school, we spend 4 years learning physiology, pathology, microbiology, pharmacology. We learn everything under the moon about how to serve our patients and how to, you know, treat the patient, not just the disease as well. We learn about all these costs to care, these barriers to care, and how patients suffer and, you know, how health outcomes suffer. And at the top of the list is always cost. Cost. That's always all what we hear. And so it begs the question, are we using our resources as efficiently as possible? And does it really need to be this expensive? The one class we don't take is on medical billing. I'll tell you that, you know, in my as an undergrad doing shadowing and doing research, and then now in medical school, I've never met a single doctor who told me they were happy with the system, how it worked. They're, every single time, it's the same complaint that I can predict and I can make small talk on is, hey, billing must suck. That's why it made sense when I, you know, heard just now that, you know, physicians were signing on to be part of Medicaid after these changes were made, even possibly specialists who would take pay cuts, because ultimately the reason they're in medicine is to treat patients, to treat disease, and not really to deal with complex bureaucracy and billing and these other things. This bill takes a step in the right direction of making sure that places like HCMC can stay open, making sure that we're serving the most vulnerable people in our society, in our communities. And I strongly urge this committee to take into consideration what's being said today. We need a system that prioritizes our patients first and foremost, and those that support patients, physicians, and other healthcare providers, and nurses who support their patients. I urge you all to vote in favor of this bill. Thank you very much for your time. Happy to be here.
Thank you, Mr. Nasser. Next up, Dr. Eileen Weber, and then we'll have Chelsea Olson. Good evening. Please state your name and proceed with your testimony, please, Dr. Weber.
Good evening. I'm Eileen Weber, and I'm a retired clinical associate professor ad honorem from the University of Minnesota School of Nursing. I'm writing to strongly encourage you to advance the Patient-Centered Care Act. House File 3476 will improve care, enhance accountability, increase access, reduce fragmentation, and save taxpayer dollars. It will end a too-long demonstration project known as PMAP, Prepaid Medical Assistance Program, which has failed to demonstrate sufficient justification for you to continue wasting public money on it. My background includes 49 years of acute care nursing, law, public health, bioethics, and interprofessional higher education of our state's healthcare providers. For me, this path down healthcare reform started as an emergency room nurse at Hennepin County Medical Center, when one night I had a patient who had to go to two ERs in order to get a prescription filled for a very minor bladder infection that would have gotten worse without the antibiotic. And the reason for that was because in her first ER, her managed care organization funneled through, or medical assistants funneled through the managed care organization, would pay for the ER visit, but not the hospital pharmacy where she was to get the prescription filled in the middle of the night. So she went home, felt worse, had to call 911 for another ambulance to take her to Hennepin County. And I thought that was ludicrous back then, and I still do. I served on the Minnesota Healthcare Commission under Governor Arne Carlson following the enactment of Minnesota Care, right around the time that the state began contracting with private managed care organizations to run multi-billion dollar publicly funded safety net healthcare programs. Minnesotans know it makes sense to eliminate middlemen in the purchase of goods and services, especially when those intermediaries' own overhead costs make those goods and services more expensive while adding no real value to the public. There is little political downside to reducing overhead costs while removing unhelpful barriers to Minnesotans' choice of healthcare providers and improving continuity of care. Unlike public entities, private managed care organizations have for too long hidden the management of public dollars behind their right to protect what they deem their proprietary information. In other words, their right to protect their profits, or what nonprofit organizations refer to as their operating margins. In the current and appropriate climate of reducing public dollar mismanagement, Such internal shielding of how tax dollars are spent or misspent is unacceptable. County-based direct contracting with healthcare providers strongly suggests there is a net gain from eliminating private MCOs from publicly funded healthcare. Because of direct contracting, you have improved reimbursement of dentists, therapists, physicians, hospitals, etc., that keep providers from closing their doors or reducing services. That improves access and economies throughout the state and is a much better use of tax dollars than buttressing up private managed care organizations who increasingly depend on public funds to stay solvent. The Patient-Centered Care Act is vitally important to the fiscal welfare of our state and the health care of some of our most vulnerable people. Please advance House File 3476. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Weber. Next up, Chelsea Olson. If you would please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Chelsea Olson with the Minnesota Council of Health Plans, the trade association representing the nonprofit health plans in Minnesota. That's Blue Cross and Blue Shield of Minnesota, Health Partners, Medica, and Sanford Health Plan of Minnesota. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today in opposition to House File 3476. We have historically testified to the value managed care provides to Minnesotans through access to care. Tonight, though, you'll hear from two individuals who have direct experience with MCO care coordination. So I'll focus my comments on the overall value of the MCO model and refuting some of the false claims that we have heard. Some have referred to MCOs as a black box. MCOs are highly regulated by DHS and CMS, and we have submitted a letter to the committee that lists the data we routinely submit. This data includes every encounter with enrollees and even the rates paid to providers. The agencies have extensive information on our operations, and many of these reports are already publicly available online. Some have claimed that MCOs are making huge profits and that the state is overpaying MCOs, extrapolating that savings could be made through eliminating MCOs. Our nonprofit health plans collectively lost over $570 million administering these programs in 2024 alone. Under this bill, those losses would have fallen on the state budget. State statute already caps MCO administrative expenses. Statute and MCO contracts establish medical loss ratios. And for 2026, contracts contain a 2% high-low risk corridor that limits margins. We have heard concerns about the use of prior authorization and formularies in managed care. However, MCOs are required to use the same formulary and PA criteria for pharmaceuticals used in fee-for-service. In some cases, PA is used less in managed care compared to fee-for-service. A 2024 fiscal note stated prior authorization denials for outpatient mental health services in fee-for-service were 40% compared to 3% in managed care. We also have concerns over impacts to other state programs, including hospital-directed payment programs, the 340B program, the Minnesota Care Waiver, and state budgeting shifts, which are all run through managed care and account for billions in the state budget. We urge a full analysis of all programmatic and fiscal impacts be completed before further action is taken on this bill. Ending the state's partnership with MCOs is also a lost opportunity to address fraud. The state program integrity director recently testified in the House Fraud Committee on the partnership with MCOs because MCOs have a vested interest in preventing fraud. MCOs have the dedicated staff, investigation teams, and technology to support access to care while preventing fraud. At the end of the day, it comes down to whether ending managed care will improve the lives of the over 1 million enrollees in managed care. And the answer is a firm no. This proposal fragments care for Minnesotans and layers additional uncertainty on top of the disruptions that will come from implementing federal HR 1 requirements. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Olson. Next up, Dr. Tom von Sternberg.
Please start.
Say, would you state your name and proceed with your testimony?
Yes. Good evening, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Christy Wolfert. I'm the Vice President of Medicaid and Duals at Medica and a registered nurse by background. I've spent the last 20 years at Medica overseeing Medicaid, dual eligibles, care models, and care coordination services. Thank you for the opportunity to share my concerns about House File 3476 and the impact it would have on people we serve. Medica is a mission-driven nonprofit health plan headquartered here in Minnesota, serving 1.7 million members across Medicaid, Medicare, employer, and individual markets. Our mission is centered on delivering high-quality, affordable, and person-centered focused care, especially for those with the most complex needs. Throughout my 30 years as a nurse, I've worked closely with this population of low-income seniors and people with disabilities. I've seen firsthand how confusing and fragmented the healthcare system is for them and for those who rely, particularly for those who rely on both Medicare and Medicaid. While these programs work reasonably well separated, they on their own are not designed to work together. Minnesota's integrated managed care models allow us to bridge a gap by coordinating those Medicare and Medicaid benefits for those members. This reduces administrative complexity and focuses on the person's individual medical, behavioral, and social needs. This approach helps people stay healthier and remain safer in their homes. There are three components that make this model successful. First, we have a network of approximately 550 care coordinators who serve as a single point of contact for these individuals. They represent a carefully curated network of contracted staff through counties, clinics, nonprofit organizations, and managed care employees that serve this population. Second, we use a person-centered care coordination model. Care coordinators complete a comprehensive health risk assessment, and then they develop an individualized plan of care that coordinates the medical, behavioral, social, dental, and pharmacy needs of these individuals. Keep in mind, the comprehensive health risk assessments are conducted as often as they can be in the member's home. So we're going in these members' home, we're doing this assessment, and we're seeing where they live. Third, care coordinators are supported by a strong wraparound infrastructure of training, oversight, auditing, and clinical support that has been built and refined through the last 30 years through partnership with other MCOs serving this population and DHS. This model works. A 2021 CMS evaluation found Minnesota Senior Health Options Program to be a national model of Medicare-Medicaid integration with fewer hospitalizations and greater use of community-based care. At Medica, our members in MSHO and the special needs basic care are 90% are reporting that they're satisfied with their care coordinator and say that the support helps them manage their health. We have long prided ourselves on an innovative collaborative approach, working closely with other plans and the Department of Human Services, continuously improving outcomes for vulnerable Minnesotans. At national meetings, the Minnesota model is consistently recognized as a leader in this space. It is viewed as what other states are trying to achieve, not move away from. Our concern is that House File 3476 would dismantle what is working. Replacing this model with a government-run framework would take years and add fiscal risk to the state and disrupt care for vulnerable Minnesotans. Minnesota is a national leader in serving these populations, and moving away from this model would take us backwards. Thank you for the opportunity to share both our successes and our concerns about House File 3476. And the impact it would have on these populations.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Wilford. I'll call again for Dr. Tom von Sternberg.
Here.
Got him. Okay. Please take a chair and introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony. Thank you.
Ah, boy. Long day. Good evening. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Dr. Tom von Sternberg, as you've heard a couple of times already. And I'm a geriatrician and a medical director of our health partners care management department. And my entire career has been focused on providing care, clinical care, and developing programs to improve the care and the lives of the elderly population at Health Partners, but also throughout Minnesota. That includes helping design the program that my colleague just referenced about the elderly Medicaid program that Minnesota is so highly valued for. I think that it's important that we talk about the advantage of a health plan's role in this space of care coordination. We have line of sight to all of the encounters and the interactions that our members have, not just within one clinic, one hospital, one care system, but throughout their navigation and journey of the care that they're receiving. The Medicaid population, and especially the elderly Medicaid population, has multiple complex chronic medical conditions. Multiple providers receive care across a variety of different settings. So the coordination of that care, it does become a level of complexity that we take very, very seriously. Our RNs and social workers are trained, as you've heard, in a variety of skills that both being patient-centered, but also ways to engage members and to help discover what their gaps are, what matters to them, and also help discover the barriers and the challenges they have with navigating a very complex medical care system, especially with the numbers of transitions that these members have. Transitions between behavioral health and medical care, transitions from hospital to nursing home to home, transitions from hospital to new care plans and home care provisions that are being needed. So that whole coordination, indeed, is an aspect of the care that we feel at Health Partners and for our care coordination department that is absolutely essential for us to do right, and we take it very seriously. Our teams are trained and are given support and resources so that they actually can deliver that coordination that's possible. For our elderly Medicaid teams, more focus and education about dementia, about frailty, fall prevention, polypharmacy, and for our behavioral health teams, it has to do with the whole issue of the complex world of chronic persistent mental illness, substance abuse, and comorbid behavioral health and complex medical conditions. It is no surprise to this room that our Medicaid population, and especially our elderly Medicaid population, has the highest concentration of these conditions. I think it's important that we also talk about how we view our role working with care delivery. And my entire emphasis in my role in a leadership position for our care coordinators is about partnership. And it's partnership with patients and families, but it's also very important that it's partnership with care delivery, with physicians, primary care, and specialty, with hospital teams, nursing home teams. That partnership, what I would call it collaboration, our job is not to duplicate or interfere with the work of care delivery, but to complement and fill in the gaps where members and families continually tell us that's where they need help. The navigation, the gaps in their understanding of their care plans, the gaps in understanding of next steps, we oftentimes will fill those gaps. And I often will say that our first call is to the patient and family. Our second call is to the physician, because it is our job to bridge those two and as I say, to fill those gaps. The difficulty that our patients and families have and the struggles they have with understanding next steps is pretty intense. Our physician and care delivery colleagues also struggle with understanding and navigating the broad array of Medicaid services, requirements, and regulations. Our care coordinators are the connection to that with a clear understanding of both networks, coverage, resources that our care delivery partners tend not to be aware of. For many of our elderly folks, that takes place in their home, as you realize. We will meet patients where they're at. Our work takes our care coordinators to hospitals, to nursing homes, to transitional care facilities, to inpatient mental health facilities, to substance use disorder facilities. So a lot of different locations we have to be connecting with people.
If you could wrap up your testimony. Thank you.
I would just offer an example where a case example might be helpful for us to talk about. I apologize for going long. I would like to talk about an individual that one of our care coordinators, Erin, has been involved with for the last couple of years. She's a 78-year-old, and she's struggling with progressive weakness and fatigue. She lives alone. She has poor memory and judgment. She's got chronic heart and kidney disease. She's had two hospitalizations in quick succession recently for falls and weakness. And she declined recommendations of the hospital for next steps of rehab therapy or in-home therapy or services, and she chose to go home. We connected with that member, and Erin was able to see her at her home and actually convince her to take on the rehab services and the home care services that were recommended. We also were able to connect with her medical care team to inform them about the gaps that we were discovering and her now agreement for services. She continued to decline with her conditions. We are able to arrange a home-based medicine care team to see her and also get more personal care to help her daughter with her caregiving responsibilities. So it's an example of how we try to help patients and families and our physician colleagues in the management of this very challenging population. And so, again, I think from our perspective, we do consider we are providing value for our Medicaid population. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Sternberger. Any other members of the public wishing to testify? Seeing none, we'll go to member discussion. Representative Nadeau.
I beat Representative Hewitt. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Liebling. You know, I haven't been here very long, but the one thing that I have learned here is that everyone that works in this industry cares deeply about the people that we serve, the healthcare outcomes. You especially care just as much as my friend Dan Andreessen over there and everyone else that works in this system, and that I appreciate so much. In 2023, my first year here, you had a bill that ended managed care. That didn't pass, but instead we turned that into a study. Implementation, there was a plan that was due on that study on the 15th of this year. In 2024, we augmented that. We added pharmacy carve-out, Medicare opt-out. We appropriated in that period $2.793 million. Do you know where that plan is, Representative Liebling?
Chair Liebling.
Mr. Chair and Representative Nadeau, I think they've been working on it, but I don't actually know where it is. However, I kind of wonder if, you know, the governor now has come out for the very first time and said that he supports removing the MCOs from our public programs for many of the same reasons that I have expressed here. And so really, for the first time, we have DHS kind of more deeply thinking about what that transition might be. So I really have no idea why those plans haven't been released yet. But, you know, I think they had hired a contractor, but I haven't actually been involved in that.
Thank you.
You know,
Representative Nadeau, I believe it's a knowable. I mean, we've had updates. It's still coming. I'm expecting it. It's later spring now.
Yeah.
Representative Nadeau.
Thank you. So I think there's been some, you know, it's last session, the managed care organizations were a little upset with me for a few things that I did. And, I try to be, equal when I find things that I think are unjust or improper, I try to go there. And, you know, but at the same time, I think we have to look at, you know, what managed care has done. And it's not a middleman. It's not a middleman at all. Does it manage risk? Absolutely. Does it pay providers? For sure it does. Does it provide navigation? Yep. It provides rides. It provides follow-up care. It is flexible to all the things that we do here, that we mandate that those organizations do. 2.3 million Minnesotans receive their health care through managed care today. 1.6 additional million Minnesotans receive administration of their health plans, of their health care through managed care plans today. There's very few states that have done what this bill is proposing to do. Connecticut is a very different animal. 68% of the Medicaid in Connecticut is covered by the federal government. Mm-hmm. 68%. We have rigid controls in Minnesota on managed care. 6.6%, we cap managed care at 6.6%. And there's a long list in statute that people long before I got here have decided that can't be used for those. And if those actual costs exceed 6.6%, for whatever reason, our commercial, they get paid through the commercial plans to keep them from operating at a loss. And if plans are making so, if they're pulling so much money out of the system, which they do report a lot, I don't think UCARE would be in the predicament it is today. You mentioned that, that they manage money. Well, UCARE is a bad money manager, apparently. But you know what? All those people received care. Mm-hmm. They all received care. And you know who hasn't been paid is Hennepin County Medical Center and the providers that are out there right now. So they're a lot more than middlemen. They're a lot more than money managers. And, their current targets for operating margins are 1.66%. And in 2025, $21 billion in claims. $3.5 billion of those dollars are prescription drugs. Overall, all the plans, 4.2% operating margins with our nonprofits between 1% and 3%. MCOs lost $570 million on our Medicaid and Minnesota Care population. So I'm not here to defend the plans, but I'm here, as I've said since the day I started, our problem is we continually add people to our public programs and don't pay the bills, and then we blame somebody else. And that's we're at this point now. We lost an insurance carrier in Minnesota. Hospitals are losing boatloads of money. That's not the plan's fault. Mm-hmm. That's not the provider's fault, I don't think. So I'm willing to continue to look at, and I love our discussions. I don't like these ones where we're not, going back and forth. I like the individual ones better, and I'm going to continue to have those with you. But I will say that this idea that DHS is going to be more transparent than plans, that's just ridiculous. I found out literally yesterday in a text that a bill that we passed last year that I worked my tail off to do is just, it's all of a sudden, they're just going to put it off for a year. I won't even bring up fraud, but if we think that agency is going to be more transparent, and I like the ASO component to this thing, but being an ASO is far more than sending out pamphlets to get care. It's bigger than that.
Representative Nuno, I've got about three or four more people.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And we did start a little bit late, so I'm going to go about 6-7 minutes past 7:45. But we have two more people on the list. Representative Carroll.
Thank you, Chair. And this is a quick technical question for the author, and I appreciate you bringing this bill. So on lines 2.1 of 2.2, I'm just trying to find out whether county-based purchasing includes Hennepin Health, which is formerly Metropolitan Health Plan, the county, Hennepin County state-certified HMO.
Chair Liebling?
Thank you.
Talking early with you, I understood that it was, but I'm not seeing it in the definitions. Again, I'm trying to do legal research on my phone, and it's not the best.
Chair Liebling?
Thank you for the question. We were talking earlier, you know, the bill is a little bit of a work in progress, and obviously it's an enormous change for the state. And so, you know, quite frankly, I've heard from Hennepin Health a little bit, but there are some things that really need to be worked on, and I've had some discussions with the county-based purchasers who we haven't talked about yet tonight, and you know, probably, although they talk in the bill about them being an ASO, it's kind of more appropriate for them to do care management rather than do that ASO function, which actually I learned they actually contract that out. So, you know, our intention is there would definitely be a role for counties, and we feel that counties are, and when I say we, I'm talking about Senator Marty and myself, who've worked closely together on this, that, and the others who are working with us, that there is a big role for care coordination, and that is best done, you know, by the counties, by community-based organizations, by providers themselves, rather than by an outside entity. And so I can't exactly answer the question tonight, but we do feel that there is a big role, of course, for the counties, which includes Hennepin County. And right now, in Hennepin County, my understanding is there are 5 MCOs all competing with each other, you know, under the latest procurement from DHS. 5 MCOs were allowed to be operating in Hennepin County, which means that any provider like HCMC has to deal with 5 different billers and 5 different organizations all for the same patient pool. So it is not only a waste of resources for the state, on the provider end, it's an enormous waste of resources and very expensive for them to have to deal with different entities for the billing. So I hope that is helpful.
Okay. Real quickly, so I just heard, as this goes on, I hope we just clarify that it includes HCMC, or excuse me, Hennepin Health, formerly Metropolitan Health Plan.
Mr. Chair, in the same way that it includes the other county-based purchasing, right, that counties are really important here, because right, counties play an important role in Minnesota, and I think that most of us really feel that they've done a good job, especially in the small counties, but also, you know, that the counties are the ones who have the incentive to make sure that their people don't fall off the cliff, because you know, so the incentives are really aligned for them and that they're a really appropriate place to be working with the patients.
Thank you. I appreciate
Chair Backer.
That.
Yeah, I'm going to be brief. We had a testifier from Connecticut, did some research here. And I understand everybody's here, they want better health care. And there are benefits to every program and there's disadvantage. But patients reported difficulty of getting appointments, especially behavioral health and complex health needs. Also, we heard a bill earlier tonight about wellness programs. The survey in Connecticut reported workforce strain showed up. And we also heard underpaying providers and shifting risks. So, of course, some of the things that we've been hearing, you know, and so forth. And the final point I'm going to lead with is, does concentrating everything in DHS, doesn't it create a single point of failure for fraud? We've seen it already. All this is concentrated even more because ASOs do not have incentives to prevent fraud like MCOs. And I know some people in this room don't like MCOs. I get it. But at the end of the day, we are responsible for taxpayers' dollars, and even more importantly, the health care of Minnesotans in this community. So thank you.
Thank you. Representative Van Binsbergen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to know, can you give a little detail about, I too want good health care, and I want affordable health care. My people in my area are screaming for affordable health care. But it looks like this is going to shift a lot of the, we're going to grow the agency, correct? I mean, are we, how many new people, what's it going to take to pull this off at DHS, a bill and a law like this?
Chair Liebling.
Mr. Chair and Representative, we are waiting on a fiscal note. It is a very complicated fiscal note because there are, as we were talking about earlier, this whole project, which has been going on for 40 years, is very complicated. And we've layered on a lot of things over the years. So to directly answer your question, it is contemplated in the bill that DHS would hire this ASO's service,
Administrative Service Organization.
Thank you, Chair Bierman. That they would not take this in-house, but would hire one or more to do it. Now, the difference would be, and it may be one of the current MCOs, because they have the apparatus already in place, they could be hired, one of them or probably could be hired to just to do the billing and to do sort of the administrative things, which is very different than taking on risk. So right now, even the MCOs, they contract out a lot of the things that we think of them as actually doing. For example, the PBMs, the pharmacy benefit managers, they're hiring the PBM. I actually had a call from someone who was hired by, who was contracted by one of the MCOs to manage care, quote unquote, and she told me that most of what she spends her time doing, and she told me that they're contracted to manage care, and most of what she spends her time doing is helping the patients get the benefits that they're supposed to get from the MCO. Instead of actually helping to manage their care. So, it is not contemplated that we would be growing DHS, but right now DHS there's a lot of internal managing. They have a lot of work to do to manage these various MCOs. So it's not like they're not already spending a lot of time and effort. I'd like to call your attention to something that was in our packets from the MCOs. They submitted a letter to us kind of with detailing all these different reports and things that they have to give to DHS that they produce, and see if I have it here. It's in our packets. It's pretty mind-boggling.
Well, we can get to that. We're out of time, really, okay. But I would like to, if you have a follow-up.
I just got one last comment to make. You are going to grow DHS. This bill is going to grow government substantially. I don't need a fiscal note to see that. And I just want to make a comment. To give more control, more power to DHS, the Department of Human Service, the Commissioner Gandhi, all we got to do is look at what's been going on the last several months in this state, and we see the fraud. We've had $9 billion or more of fraud, and most of it's come out of that agency. And we're going to turn and we're going to expand and give them more authority? I'm a no.
Thank you. Chair Liebling, if you want a brief closing, a minute.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, thank you, members. Giving more power to DHS, this is our public programs, and these are our tax dollars. And right now, we as legislators do not know where the money is going, and we have very little control and even less ability to find out really where any of this is going. So, this is our public program. These programs do not belong to the private sector. They are our responsibility. And for those of you who don't trust government, you are government. You are government, and you are responsible for this. So when $20 billion in taxpayer money is flowing through this system, you have to answer to your constituents that you understand where this money is going and what it is buying. And I submit to you that you cannot, because this is a black box, And your constituents deserve to know that we are responsible for this, and whether you don't like government, but you are government. So, Mr. Chair, thank you very much
for
hearing the bill.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. You have successfully pulled the Band-Aid off tonight, and there's a lot more to talk about, but at least we've started. Chair Liebling renews the motion that House File 3476, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you, Representative Liebling. Thank you, members. We are adjourned.